tonight I'm very pleased to welcome somebody who, interesting figure, because as you know, I'm a journalist by career, my past career, and journalists are very much supposed to see public relations people as creatures from what we call the dark side. Public relations is obviously an evil practice where people seek to distort reality, and brave journalists try to reveal the truth. Tonight's speaker is somebody who's actually been on both sides of that divide and is going to try and make the case that somehow public relations is actually a force for good in the world. And you remain to be to see if you're convinced by that. But he is remarkably well placed to do so. Ed Amery used to work for, well, he used to work in politics, political communications, indeed with the current Prime Minister at one point, then worked at highly journalistic and interesting organisations like the Daily Mail and the Spectator, yep. Spectator as well for a long period, before crossing over, if you like, into public relations with Freud Communications. Freud Communications in itself is a really interesting company. Matthew Freud, the founder, is a fascinating person. Go and look at him on the internet. And Freud Communications itself has been highly successful in corporate areas, in political areas, but also working on really interesting projects like Band-Aid, you know, Bono and Geldof and so on as well, and is currently expanding into all sorts of new areas as well. So I think it's going to be really interesting to hear from one of the key figures at Freud's about whether that, you might say, invasion or you might say expansion into ever more areas of public relations is good. So please give a warm welcome to Ed Amery.
I feel very nervous about that. The collective brain power of the LSE collective in front of me. And I hope you'll all ask me some really mean and horrible questions when I finish talking. I set the topic for this talk deliberately, slightly provocatively, because I wanted, as much as anything else, to try and prove to myself that I could make the case. And you can, I might have a vote afterwards and see whether you think I've succeeded or not. For much of my life, I pretended to be indifferent about whether I was engaged in a socially responsible activity or not. So my first job was in politics, and my first boss was David Cameron, and there he is, looking very modern. And I worked for the Conservative Party. And you may find it strange that I and most of the people with whom I work believe that we were trying to make a better world. But unfortunately, nearly everyone else not only disagreed with the policies that we were pursuing, but started from the assumption that politicians and their advisers were crooked, deceitful, and self-interested. And that you probably won't remember this, but this was Spitting Image, which was the political satire of the time. After a bit, although I like to think the kernel of idealism remained, I became a bit wary about expressing it in public. And then I became a journalist, and after a few other jobs, I found my way to the Daily Mail. And when I worked before for the Spectator, and now the cartoonist at the Spectator drew this cartoon when I left, and there I am crawling up from the Spectator down there to the Daily Mail, which is like a more formidable institution up there. And there, once again, we understood that an element of hypocrisy was essential for a mass market newspaper. But despite that, I and those who work with me essentially believed that we were a force for good, calling the powerful to account on behalf of the powerless. But once again, although I did defend the mayor in public, I did so without the expectation that those to whom I spoke would believe me. And then finally, I arrived... yes, there was the Daily Mail. That was basically the prevailing attitude that I... encountered with people's attitude towards my working at the Daily Mail. Okay, now I've arrived in public relations, and here perhaps this says something about my broad personality. I found another profession that was largely regarded with contempt by the world outside. I joined Perfect Curve. Anyone who watches W1A will, I hope, recognise Perfect Curve. Or I was a wicked puppet master in the pay of dictators. That's basically the two prevailing views, I think, about PR. Either we are sinister or laughable. On this occasion, however, I've concluded that the PR business must launch a bit of a fight back, and that's why I've come along to see that. It's not because I wanted to be better regarded personally. I gave up on that a long, long time ago. It's because I'll only succeed at my day job if companies like Freud's attract employees who are driven ultimately by a practical social conscience. So today I thought I would explain why I believe that PR can create a better world. As I say, we'll have a vote at the end. PR has an interesting history. Public relations is a relatively modern word. One of its founders, who coined the term Public Relations Council to describe his own job, was Edward Bernays. And there's Edward Bernays. He was an American. He was also a relation, an uncle, I think, of Matthew Freud, my current boss. His most famous exercise was persuading a lot of American women that they should associate smoking with emancipation, which perhaps nowadays we might not approve of. Although Bernays may have called himself a PR man, he preferred to think of himself as engaged in propaganda. Sorry, we'll go back. He wrote a very interesting book attempting to rehabilitate the word. It's entitled Propaganda, and I recommend it to him. I don't think his attempts, however, would find much traction today. He was an avid follower of an American thinker called Walter Lippmann. And Mr. Lippmann wasn't a huge Democrat. Mr. Lippmann didn't think that the people in a democracy could be trusted to make sensible decisions. Instead, he thought that a small group of dedicated and intelligent individuals should guide the masses towards the correct decisions using propaganda. He must have been rather disappointed by how well the National Socialists in Germany demonstrated that they'd learned this lesson shortly afterwards. So I hardly feel disappointingly that this is a good case for a moral defence for today's public relations practitioners. So a more modern attempt at self-justification for PR might involve the application of ethics. Now, I'm not much of an ethicist. I did try and read Spinoza's Ethics at university, but I didn't get past the pages where he tried to define the terms. It's just too much for me. But to guide my researchers, I found a very helpful article entitled Ethics in Public Relations. It's true it was funded by the Institute for Public Relations, but we mustn't let that stand in its way. It does confront some of the issues. It asks, for a start, whether public relations ethics is an oxymoron. It cites critics who argue that PR is having a deleterious impact on the democratic process by giving vested interests the opportunity to deliberately obfuscate, deceive, and derail public debate on key issues. Sounds very wicked. And it goes on to point out some of the more famous examples of public relations bad behaviour. I particularly like the one where Hill & Knowlton, who is a public relations firm, apparently created a fake group entitled Citizens for a Free Kuwait in order to help persuade the US to enter the 1992 Gulf War. There we are, Citizens for a Free Kuwait. The citizens were all in Hill & Knowlton's office. Unfortunately, however, when the article moved on to what PR professionals might do to behave in an ethical manner, seemed to boil down to more training, so that they might better advise corporate chief executives to behave decently. Apparently, people in my profession need training how to spot an ethical dilemma and what to do when you face one. Somehow, Edward Bernays was more convincing than this. So, today, I'd like to offer an alternative view based on my job. Two forces are currently colliding that are changing the relationship between business and society. The first is a profound failure of trust. At school, studying A-level economics, I had a copy of Milton Friedman's Free to Choose, which had been published a couple of years before, because I am very old. There it is. His view that markets left to themselves produce a positive outcome for everyone carried a good many people before him. But more recently, there has been a backlash. A determined campaign by some of the world's largest and most successful corporations to avoid paying tax in the countries where they sell most products. And I may have read this week that Facebook pays precisely £4,327 in tax in the UK last year. It's just one example of the way in which firms, left to their own devices, behave with impressive selfishness. The recent recession reinforced such a coming. Thumbs up for Facebook and their £4,000. The recent recession reinforced the sense in the public mind that few powerful individuals and corporations reap the rewards, while the many, in the shape of the taxpayer and the workers, take the ultimate risks. And Freud does a lot of research in this area, and the level of public distrust in what you might call institutions is at a historical low. So firms find it harder to acquire a social license to operate, and they're given absolutely no benefit of the doubt when things go wrong. The increasing expectation as a result of this from politicians, regulators, the media, the public, consumers, is that a firm must demonstrate a purpose beyond profit. By that I mean that they must explicitly demonstrate to the societies in which they do business how they benefit those societies. The profit motive, the greed agenda, is no longer enough. Some of you may remember Gordon Gekko's speech about greed in Wall Street. There we go, Gordon Gekko. He said, and I've always loved this as a speech, I used to be a speechwriter once upon a time, and it's a great speech. Greed clarifies, cuts through and captures the essence of the evolutionary spirit. Greed in all its forms, greed for life, for money, for love, for knowledge, has marked the upward surge of mankind. I think there is now a collective acceptance that this is total rubbish. So that's the first factor, a change in the way that people regard business. Milton Friedman is dead. The second factor that's changed is the movement for what I think you might call the movement for effective altruism. Doing good used to be put in a box that you might call charity. If you wanted to change the world for the better, you had to work for Oxfam, the UN, or perhaps you could become a doctor. Now, these days, it might be better to join a hedge fund. Peter Singer, who is an American professor, who's one of the leaders of the effective altruism movement, talks about one of his recent philosophy graduates who, on leaving university, went to join a firm trading options because he said he'd be able to make more money that he would then be able to devote to good causes. The point of this movement is that it's not enough to mean well. You have to be effective as well. And that means using business techniques, including making a profit, this is just a bit dirty word, to produce ethical outcomes. For example, some of you may be familiar, or many of you may not, but I am, with the Peterborough Social Impact Bond. Investors fund rehabilitation schemes for criminals who are leaving prison. If the reoffending rate falls below the national average, they receive a return on their investment. This kind of approach has led to the development of a whole new class of individuals, social entrepreneurs, who apply the attitude and techniques of an entrepreneur to solving social problems. Freud does a lot of work with an organisation called Ashoka, which was set up by an American ex-McKinsey partner called Bill Drayton, who actually coined the term social entrepreneur. One of my favourite... I was told by Joe that I had to turn up with slides. There we go, my slides. But basically, I'm not a slide person. One of my favourite Ashoka fellows trains giant rats from Tanzania to sniff out landmines. They're cheaper than dogs. They'll do anything for a banana. And the profits from their activities go back to Africa, not Europe. Profits, investment, business thinking, but positive social outcomes. The distinction between the second and third sectors of institutional life is disappearing. So, I was kind of setting the scene. What do these two movements mean for PR? On the one hand, companies now increasingly accept that they must demonstrably benefit the societies in which they operate. On the other, there's an increasing acceptance that business techniques help to achieve social outcomes. Put together, this leads to a third conclusion. Companies will succeed financially in the longer term if they benefit society, and the society will benefit from allowing such companies to thrive. So let me give you, I'm talking very fast because I know I've got to get through it, but let me give you a practical illustration. I spoke last year to the Chief Sustainability Officer of IKEA. He gave me two interesting examples of IKEA. First, he explained that IKEA had allowed a designer to spend a year redesigning one lamp. At the end of the year, the newly designed lamp could be manufactured with half as much raw material. This was good for the environment, less consumption, but also good for the company because it was substantially cheaper. Second, he explained that they completely redesigned the way they manufacture a sofa to allow them to fit more easily into containers for sea transport. The less sweet air, I love this phrase, apparently air that is not filled by product in containers, but sweet air. The less sweet air remained in the container, the cheaper the transport became for IKEA, but of course also the less carbon emissions for the planet. So let me give you another example. A couple of weeks ago, I spoke to the Chief Health Officer of Vitality Group. They are an insurance company with its origins in South Africa, now worldwide. They launched a groundbreaking scheme which provided incentives for those who insured to live healthier lives. So customers can get subsidized gym membership, cheaper health foods, cheaper premiums if their smartphone app demonstrates that they're running sufficiently number of times around a certain time. Vitality customers get healthier, but at the same time the company benefits because it pays less for their health care. The result is that the firm has grown rapidly around the world. They've learned how to make profits by doing the right thing. There's another side to this argument. What happens to firms that continue to behave like Gordon Gekko? Let me give you some recent examples. More than $30 billion has been wiped off the value of Volkswagen since it emerged that they've been cheating on environmental regulations. Shell recently wrote off about $10 billion after discovering that the financial cost of the damage to their reputation from drilling in the Arctic outweighed the profits that they might have made from doing that drilling. That's Volkswagen. Get there in a moment. Or to take a much smaller example, I like this one, closer to home, where WH Smith were discovered to be charging up to 45% more for basic items in shops and hospitals, presumably on the grounds that the patients were too ill to see choice. Within days of this being revealed, they backed down and equalised their prices. Reputation, they discovered, has a measurable financial impact. Ignore that and chief executives will be fired. But, and here we come onto the role of PR, finally. But I have got here. Not all companies are enlightened as Vitality and IKEA. Many understand that there's a pressure from society to behave differently, but struggle to identify the path they should take to achieve that. The corporate social responsibility movement was an early response to this. Basically, its attitude that you could make shed loads of money over here, but then we can all feel better if we give a little bit of it back over there. This, of course, is not the point at all, and consumers and opinion forms see straight through this kind of behaviour. The companies concerned reap no reputational dividend, nor do they see their profits rising. Firms need to make far more significant changes if they're to bridge the trust gap. This kind of change comes with costs attached, so they often need advice and support on how, first of all, to see the benefits of changing the way they do business, and second, on how to manage this transition to a new world. This is not advice they are going to receive from McKinsey, because it's very hard to measure it, at least initially, in purely financial terms. So that's why a company like Mars, a Freud's client, is trying to develop metrics to move to a triple bottom line that will measure its social and environmental as well as its financial impact. It's not easy, but only when managers in every bit of Mars can have their performance measured against all three metrics will the way they behave fundamentally change. So companies that want to make this transition can come to an organisation like Freud's and seek advice. Some of these companies want advice on how to behave better, of course, to become better and perhaps even more profitable for corporate citizens. One current client is a large but relatively unknown UK wealth manager. We've been discussing with them how they can behave better as a business, offering more transparent deals with less hidden costs. Investing more responsibly as part of a plan to expand their business, doing well by being seen to do good. Other companies are essentially positive already, but they're not receiving the reputational dividend that they deserve, and we can help them get their just desserts. A current client of mine offers loans on mobile phones in sub-Saharan Africa. His firm's activities are potentially transformational. They offer entrepreneurs instant credit with no collateral at the touch of a button in the middle of the African bush. But if he's to obtain the investment he needs, he must ensure he has a decent reputation in London and in San Francisco, that the people there understand the social value of his activities. So here, PR is a facilitator, explaining and quantifying the advantages of good behaviour, ensuring that this good behaviour receives the reputational and financial returns that it deserves. So, it's not about propaganda. It's not about spurious ethical arguments. It's about playing a practical role in creating a better world, a world in which companies can make money by working for the common good. And I accept this is perhaps a little idealistic. There will be many examples of firms not behaving like this. There will be many examples of PR professionals giving advice of which Spinoza would not approve, covering up the bad behaviour of corporate wrongdoers. Even Freud does some work that will not necessarily make the world a better place. But, and I take a brief deep breath when I say this, I firmly believe that the potential exists for PR to create a better world. And unlike in my two previous jobs, I now believe that I and my profession need to do a better job of making this argument in public. So thank you all for your time today. And I'm very happy to take questions about this or about any aspect of my future or past careers.
Okay, my own opinion is PR is not intrinsically good or bad. It's just a tool for empowering a client who may be good or bad themselves. I think the trouble is collectively, because I work in PR, so this is a concern that we have, and by one stat I read recently, PRs are outnumbering journalists, what's it, 1.5 to 1. There's just so many that's making such a noise. Wouldn't the world be better if there were just some of us shut up? We're just adding to all of this cacophony.
Well, when I was a journalist, I used to think that the principal value of journalism, a lot of people have said that journalism would die with the internet. But there would be so much material out there that why would anyone bother to pay for it? What has actually happened is that the more material is put out there, the more important it is that you have someone who's filtering it all out, who's making a selection. So yes, it would probably be better if there were less PRs. On the other hand, people need information. Then they need to, and companies need to receive a dividend. If they're going to behave, to take the argument I was making today, if a company is going to behave well, it needs to receive a dividend for behaving well, otherwise why would it bother? So it needs the PRs to tell people if it's behaving well so that it's rewarded for it. So it needs the PR.
An issue that I have with this idea of companies, contributing to a better world by having different investment in socially beneficial projects, is that it seems as if being good or bad is not a matter of, it's sort of black and white. So if a company, for example, let's say, invests in one thing that is good socially in, let's say, Britain, but then goes and outsources its production somewhere in Bangladesh, and rids itself of the responsibility of how it produced the product that it dealt for a good cause, then I don't see how this company is doing better in the world, because then the good thing is basically just the cover for the bad thing.
Well, I think it's a very good point. There are less hiding places than there used to be. The world is more connected. If you're Apple and workers are being treated badly in one of your factories in China where your materials are being manufactured, people in New York are quite likely to find out about it.
So there is. That's the thing. Foxconn happened, and we know that people have been trying to sue Apple and Samsung for having been paralysed for so long, and it didn't happen. The same kind of code, the same message. I see how PR may be good in enhancing certain aspects of a company that may be good on one side of the world, but it's sort of covering up the other aspects of that company. And
I'm not saying it never happens, but I mean, okay, let me give you two practical examples. I've got a friend who runs a large clothing company based in the UK. His manufacturer is mostly in the Far East. And he is very well aware that there are stories in the paper about how people are treated badly in factories producing his stuff, that will have an impact on his sales. So he goes out every year and he walks around those factories and has a jolly good look at them and he tries to make sure that people in them are being treated decently. He's not just walking away, he is aware that there is an impact. I'll give you another example. So there's a confectionery manufacturer that I work with. They source their cocoa products in Africa, in places like the Ivory Coast. And they are making a major effort. And it's complicated because it's very small farmers and they're a very big company. But they are making a major effort to try and ensure that those farmers are properly paid and properly for the cocoa beans that they're buying. Because they know that will have an impact all the way back through to the people who are buying the chocolate off the street in London. So it doesn't always happen. And companies, of course companies try and fake it. But the opportunities for getting away with that are diminishing.
You mentioned that before you worked with some clients who said our companies aren't very well behaved.
Yes.
If you really wanted to bring about PR as a good force in the world, why don't you recruit those clients? Why don't you make examples?
Okay, so I shall choose my words very carefully. Freud's, unlike some PR companies, partly because it is privately owned, says no to some potential clients. We apply a filter. It's not when I said that some of Freud's clients behave badly. I'm not sure I quite said that. What I said is that some of the things they do are not making the world a better place. So some of the PR activities in which we engage are just about selling product. There isn't much purpose element to them. We always tell our clients, don't lie. And we always tell the truth to our clients. I'm not saying every PR company does that. I'm not saying that. The point I was making is that not everything that we do as a company purpose, and I wouldn't pretend that to be the case, but I don't think that I work for any clients who I'm not ultimately comfortable with.
Can we just go to the back just to pick up some questions? Can you shout out as well?
Sure, yeah. I appreciate the way that you characterized the work you do, but I would just ask, above what proportion on an annual basis of the clients that you take on would fall into that category of e-corporate, somebody who is doing good by design?
Well, and obviously some clients, it's nice and easy. So if you're Pearson, for instance, and your product is education, it's very easy to see how that would have a positive impact in the world. If you're a food company selling food that is not necessarily massively healthy, where you'd eat too much of it. Then it might be more difficult to understand how that would be the case. However, if that company behaves towards its customers, towards its suppliers, towards its employees in a positive way, then hopefully that will demonstrate that the company is having a socially positive impact, despite what it might be selling. Clearly. If you're working for a large organisation, you hope that the purpose from the top of the organisation is essentially a positive one. Whether that gets translated into every single aspect of the work that organisation does, I don't think we're quite there yet.
Take your pick.
Thanks for the talk. And you used to be a journalist, and then you went over to a PR. Yep. So what is the reason for that? And how do you see the differences and similarities between journalists and PR, these specific roles?
Okay, well, that's a good question. And a lot of people have asked me, over the years, including my friends and family, why I stopped being a journalist. The truth is that I was a slightly, I wasn't a proper journalist like Charlie. I'd started my career in politics. So I was a political advisor before I became a journalist. So in a way, I started on the, if you were to use the characterization that Charlie used earlier, I started on the dark side. I went over to the light and now I've gone back to the dark. I personally don't see it like that. I think that the relationship between people who are doers and reporters is a symbiotic one. So when I was a politician, or when I worked in politics, I tried to provide information about what we were doing to the media so that they would be better able to report on what we were doing, so that we would be able to achieve the outcomes that we wanted us in politics. I do that now in PR. So I don't think it shouldn't be an oppositional relationship. It should be a symbiotic one. Some journalists would regard the idea of a symbiotic relationship between PR and the media as the height of wickedness, but I don't. And if you were to ask me why, I'll be very honest, if you were to ask me why I left journalism, it's because I didn't want to be, I worked for the Daily Mail, and I didn't want to be the editor of the Daily Mail, and I wanted a new challenge. And journalism is a really exciting and fun career, and you can get an enormous amount of influence and adrenaline quite quickly. But if you don't want to move on within the career structure in journalism, you can get a bit stuck.
It's always good to change, isn't it? Let's go right to the back.
I think so. Well, I used to be a journalist, and one of the most problematic PR professionals I used to encounter was people who used to work for the big tobacco company. They would have a lot of CSR kind of efforts, campaigns, but I don't know. In your view, your personal view, when is it? Is it ethical to do PR for the tobacco companies? No matter how altruistic your
campaigns are. Well, we don't work for tobacco companies. I wouldn't judge anyone who did. But I think that I would be uncomfortable personally about working for an organisation that was selling something that you knew was damaging to people's health.
Just keep getting loads of questions, fantastic. Cliff.
So there is an increasing reliance of journalism on PR nowadays, and you find more and more journalists now recycling material provided by PR. Sometimes you would find almost like 80-90% journalism in these articles. As a journalist, as someone who's worked as a journalist and a PR, what's your opinion on this increasing dependence of journalism on
Well, I was when I the aspect of journalism that I did was largely political journalism, which was not doesn't have quite the same relationship with PR companies. The reason that journalism is more dependent on PR than it used to be is because the financial models that have supported journalism have broken down. My former newspaper is still very profitable, but a lot of organisations are not, and that's why they're taking content directly from PR or from companies or directly from commercial firms. I think that's fine, provided it's very clear where the material is coming from. It needs to be clearly signposted. I mean, a lot of companies now essentially act as their own publishers. So we produce a lot of content that goes directly to audiences on social media or even, we're working with one client currently to produce a feature film. We've done documentaries, we do books. So there's a lot of content that goes directly to consumers. I'm fine with it going into the media, provided it's clear where it came from. But that's up to the media. It's also up to the media, frankly, to create new financial models to support their activities.
Yes.
It sounds like you're saying that
healthcare basically is just mitigating the increasing democratization of business, basically. That there's more access to information around businesses, and there's more activity from consumers to either boycott a company or shame them on Twitter or do anything to make them look bad. And so, what's the difference then between PR and the private sector and then political communication?
It's interesting. When I first joined Freud's, there was a chap who sadly died called Philip Gould, who had worked with Tony Blair, and he came up with this concept of democratic consumerism, which was he came from a political background, and his idea was that he could take some of the ideas and techniques about democracy that had come from the political world and translate them over into the commercial world. I think there is a crossover, but there are limits. One of the things that interests me is if you've got a really compelling product, say you're Amazon or Apple, then it seems that consumers don't really care very much how you behave. What companies like Amazon and Apple should be aware of, however, is that when things go wrong or they make a mistake, and they will, then they will have nothing to draw on, no reputation in the bank, because they essentially behave pretty badly. But so there are limits to the extent to which you can take the democratic model and prompt it down into the commercial world. But I agree that there is a gradual transition.
Sorry. Yeah, please.
You mentioned that a lot of people are moving towards trying to drive towards a single bottom line. I'm interested in your experience of how well this guy is, but also what their incentives to doing that, because that would obviously impact their communications. Because if at the end of the day they're asking for shareholders, I mean, can't you just think and consider or think that communications are more greenwashed than actually kind of structural change, especially when you might have to balance profit with some sort of outcome.
So Mars, which is moving to a triple bottom line, is a family-owned company. So they can take a longer-term perspective. And they believe that if they do the right thing for society and the right thing for the environment, that eventually they will make more money. So that is actually what I mean. There is not a trade-off. In the longer term, you'll do the right thing. And you're more profitable as a result. I think in the short term, there is a real problem with quarterly reporting, and one of the very few companies that's attempted to behave like this in the that is a shareholder-owned company is Unilever. And when Paul Polman took over as the chief executive of Unilever, the very first thing he did was say that he was not going to be quarterly reporting anymore, and that shareholders were going to have to wait. And he would report once a year on what was happening. And then luckily, in the case of Unilever, he has been largely successful. And he would say, and he's a much better advocate for this than I am, he would say that those brands of his that are driven by a sense of purpose, social purpose, are substantially more successful than the brands that aren't.
So there seems to be a lot of emphasis on companies playing an ethical role. So my question to you is, what makes PR agencies such as Freud a credible player in policing the quality of reputation in particular ethics?
Well, I would be very, very nervous about setting myself up as an ethical policeman of any kind. I don't think that it's our job, and I would consider myself deeply unqualified to police the ethics of the firms with which I work. What I do believe is that PR firms can ensure that companies get a return on behaving ethically. Eventually, it is the media and consumers who will be the police the ethics, the behavior of companies. What PR firms can do is ensure that the consumers and the media have the right information to make their judgments.
From what you said, I gather that it's either the reason that companies choose to adopt this kind of more ethical behavior is because there was no publicly traded company, so there's like a direct impact of some form in their finances to behaving that way. or because it's just a cultural thing, like the family that owns it or whoever owns it decides, and it's a top-down sort of approach. In your experience, are either of these trends increasing or decreasing, and if so, what parts of the world, and is there another incentive or kind of way that or element that is making companies make that change, or have you not seen that?
I think the process is increasing because, as I said it earlier, I think that there's a general sense in society that they're pretty fed up with companies not behaving in the interest of the societies in which they operate. And I did some work with I don't work with them now, so I can say I did some work with the Royal Bank of Scotland. Now, the Royal Bank of Scotland, for those who don't know, was a large British bank. That nearly went broke at the time of the financial crisis, and the British taxpayer had to put £40 billion into bailing it out. And essentially, the taxpayer took a hit, while the bankers in the Royal Bank of Scotland went on paying themselves very large bonuses. So there's a sense in which society pays the price, and a few go on reaping the rewards. And there is, and that's led, examples like that have led to a very strong sense, not just in the UK but worldwide, that companies left to themselves don't behave well. So there's a pressure for them to behave differently. Well, that's not true everywhere. I suppose the only, you asked me whether there are any other factors that are trending in that direction. I think that kind of movement is allowing politicians to feel a new confidence about stepping in and regulating the market. So Hillary Clinton gave a very interesting speech, funny enough, about quarterly reporting and what a tyranny it was, because it had a bad impact on capitalism. So I think there was a sense in which some politicians who might in the past have stepped back and said, well, companies can go on and behave the way however they like, as long as they're making profit, they're now prepared to step in. So that's another factor.
We've got time for another couple. There's one there.
Yeah, so we say that if you do, it's the company that we have to drive, so you can actually your job in spreading information. So that is the goal of the job. It's only a kind of spreading information, and then I get a part of the board.
Well, obviously, ultimately, PR is about disseminating information. But quite often, what I do, people who work with me do is to help craft that information. I'll do my best to encourage companies to behave in ways that create information that I would wish to disseminate. Volkswagen, I think, is rather a good case in point, because yes, they did choose, but they got caught, and it's not whatever they did in credit or the value of their company. You can see the value the consumers put on companies telling the truth. I think a lot of I wish there were more Volkswagen, because chief executives around the world look at that and think, well, it's not worth telling lies.
Ed, just one, I was going to ask the last question, which is, you used an interesting phrase earlier when you talked about looking for people who'd come into your industry or your company who had a particular sense of purpose or something.
Practical social.
Can you describe that, and also more generally,
what you think would make good PR executives for people thinking of a career in this apparently ethical industry.
That's a very leading one. Okay, we're looking for people who are bright, who think analytically, who can solve problems. That's basically what I do in my day job. I go into the office, I'm presented with a new client. That new client will have an often very complex business that I know nothing about. I have to learn about that business very, very quickly, understand what the critical problems are and how to make changes to that. At the same time, and I think this is not just true of PR actually, but it's true of most professions, the thing that we really value is creative ideas. There's a lot of, you can hire, if I'm being honest, you can hire very bright people who can think in a linear way quite easily. The real value in every business now is who's got the big new idea. So it's very, part of my job is thinking through that sort of assimilating a lot of facts very quickly, something that you will be taught to do here at the OIC, and drawing analytical conclusions from that. But the more interesting, the more important thing is how do you then make a big jump to ideas that might be transformative for your clients.
Just, I should have done this at the beginning, actually, but let's do it now anyway. Hands up those of you who agree with Ed's proposition that PR is a force for good in the world. Come on. Those of you who are absolutely certain that it's not a force for good in the world. Okay.
You win.
All right.
I think that was polite.
You've all let me down.
Well, thank you very much, Ed. Thank you.